This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We hope you'll stay tuned.
The current state of rural America, you know, and obviously, like with all generalizations, there's exceptions to the rule. There are farm families that are doing great and wonderful and making money for a variety of reasons, but they are the rarity. And, you know, in town after town, what we found in rural America is that we have moved the low-income manufacturing jobs that used to be in those places have been moved overseas. What we found is that the farm crisis, which started in the 80s and never stopped, has once again intensified to a level that we really haven't seen since the peak of the farm crisis a decade ago. We're seeing 500 family farms a week going under, and basically, when you have that kind of an economic situation, it spills over into the towns. You know, the fellow who sells, you know, drugs at the drugstore is having as much trouble making it now in a small town of, say, 2,000 out in rural America as the farmers, because those are his customers. So it really plays into the entire community, and you can end up with a very, very disturbed, very upset, very depressed bunch of people. It's not a healthy situation at all.
Well, you say the farm crisis that never stopped. I know for a while, I mean, we were certainly seeing a fair amount of coverage about what was happening on family farms. You know, there were some concerts and things like that. That coverage faded to some degree from the news, but I'm hearing you say that things are just as bad as they were?
Sure. And what happened, I mean, what people don't realize, you know, being a journalist, which is what I am, I mean, I very much am, you know, knew at the time what was going on. We didn't, the farm crisis didn't end. We simply got bored reporting it. Or more than that, readers and listeners got bored hearing about it. And so our editors and our publishers all said, you know, oh, not another farm crisis story. You know, move on from there. And so what happens is after you report on a story for, used to be, you know, a few months or even years, you know, it was time to move on. But now it seems that we get bored with a story after only a few, you know, days at most. I mean, I've done stories that, you know, I've had publishers tell me, well, it's, you know, don't do another story on that subject. And you say, but I'm doing follow-ups and nothing's changed yet. You know, I have to keep reporting that story because, you know, nothing is any different. You know, it's still happening. But that's really the mentality out there. And at the end of the 80s, we were very tired about hearing about the farm crisis. Really, in like by 87, we were tired of hearing about it. And most major media just quit reporting on it.
You bring up this really interesting point about how media increasingly is all about, well, whatever is happening now, and we're going to devote 5 minutes to it and move on. And it really doesn't allow for people to have any kind of real understanding about what's happening in the world around them.
Right. Well, you know, as what's happened as the media industry itself has consolidated, you know, it's been happening for 100 years, but we've now hit this accelerated consolidation that I think astounds most people. Just at the beginning of the 80s, really there were about 50 companies that controlled over half of the media in the United States. And I'm talking about everything from music to movies to the news to entertainment, you know, just everything that you can conceive of as being media. Over half of that was owned by 50 companies. And at that time, people were saying, this is terrible. You know, this is very dangerous to have such, you know, so few companies, you know, to, you know, controlling all of our newspapers and television and everything. Well, since that time, there's now only 9 companies that control over half of the media of the entire world. So that's how much more consolidated it has become. And as that's happened, you know, these companies are not what you would think of as being, you know, news companies. These are GEs and Time Warner, AOLs and Disney's. These are people that are in the business of making money, and they simply apply the same rules basically to their news divisions as they do to their entertainment. And if you're in the news business to make money, you're not going to spend a lot of time talking about important economic or geopolitical stories, because those don't draw viewers. Those don't give you higher ratings. Those don't allow you to charge more money for your commercials. Whereas if you do sensational crimes and O.J. Simpsons and JonBenet Ramsey's and the Melendez brothers and all those things and John Wayne Bobbitt, then you're going to be able to increase your ratings, which allows you to charge millions of dollars more for your advertising space. So the allotment to serious stories is ridiculous. I'll give you a perfect example. I was talking just the other day to someone who was interested in putting together a news bit on my my new book, The Perpetual Prisoner Machine, and we did a television person did a long interview, and they said, I don't know how we can tell this story in less than 4 minutes. And I said, well, I don't know how either. And I said, but, that's my whole point of the book. I said, you could sure get in a good crime story in 4 minutes, though, couldn't you? And that's the truth of it. It's hard to tell an important, complicated political story in 4 minutes. It's easy to say that somebody, shot a liquor store clerk at the corner of 62nd Street and took $27 out of the cash register. That fits in real good. So that's really the direction that the media has gone. And, stories about, even if people are aware that the farm crisis is back in full swing and happening again, they don't know why. They hear that commodity prices are low, and that's true. But they don't realize that commodity prices are lower than they've been in a century, that, farmers are getting less for wheat than they got in 1917. They don't realize that the reason for that is because we've allowed the food industry to become fully monopolized. And so there's no competition out there for the crops, and the companies simply offer less than it costs to raise them. And if you don't want to sell, they go on to someone else, and yours rots in the field, and you go belly up the next year.
We're talking with Joel Dyer, author of The Harvest of Rage. Joel, let's talk about what's happened and is happening in rural middle America, for lack of another term, right at this moment. I mean, we're not just talking about people losing their jobs, which would be bad enough. We're talking about people losing their lives and their livelihoods and their heritage as well.
Right. And, that's really been one of the hardest things for me. I've been covering this now for well over a decade. And I can't claim to understand the amount of grief and the emotion that is there for people that are losing their farms, losing their land. I see it, I know it's there, but having not grown up on a farm, I don't really, sense it myself. The farm, if you talk to the rural psychologists and the people that do know what this is like, they describe it as being much worse than actually a death in the family. It's not like losing a job at all. You're losing most likely your great grandfather's farm, your grandfather's, your father left it to you. You were supposed to leave it to your kids. So you have this sense of really disappointing, all of your relatives who have come before. You feel like you're the failure that, wasn't able to carry on this tradition that's been going on for 100 years. You become very depressed and beat yourself up over that. And, the land is very much the connection, to patriotism and God and to an entire way of life. So when that farm is ripped out through foreclosure, away from a family, it's very much like they lose, it's like re-experiencing the death of all of their families, their history and everything all at once. And it has led, the depression there, the best way to describe how serious it is to realize that outside of natural causes, the number one killer on the family farm in the United States for the last couple of decades has been suicide. And, that should, sober everyone up and help them to realize just how bad what I'm talking about is. The increases that have happened in the last, 20 years in rural America, and particularly farm areas, of spouse abuse, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, child abuse, all these things that stem from this long-term depression have increased and really created just a terrible scenario out there. And there, back in the 80s, we provided a lot of government funding for programs and rural psychologists and hotlines, and the churches were very involved in trying to reach out to the farm families. But as the farm crisis fell out of the news and people stopped thinking about it, some of the first funding cuts that came under, you know, toward the end of the Reagan era were basically to get rid of the funding for rural mental health care and psychologists. Churches cut back on their hotlines. They didn't think they needed them anymore. And so it really pulled the rug out from under everyone, even though the problem didn't go away. The opportunity to help those people went away.
There is already in many rural areas, probably most rural areas, a lack of services and assistance anyway, since those things have a tendency to congregate like everything else in more urbanized areas. And so what we have a whole segment of the population basically abandoned on any number of levels, really, right?
Sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, you know, if you look at it in the most practical sense, you know, most families that are under this kind of stress are there because of the economics, and the very few rural hospitals and programs that are still available are basically owned by HMOs and things now, and they require insurance. Well, if you're you know, so economically strapped that you're losing your home anyway, what are the odds that you have any kind of medical insurance? They're really pretty non-existent. So, you know, we replaced a public system, you know, under the guise of cost cutting and saving tax money. We replaced a public system with a private one, and the people that we're talking about who need this kind of help are needing this help because they don't have any money. So they're really left all alone for the most part. A few states in the last couple of years, or last year and a half, have started to once again implement some programs. Nebraska has done a great job of making any person that needs mental help health care because of their economic status and losing their farm can get access. But that hasn't happened across the board like it did in the 80s.
This is Full Logic Reverse. We'll be back in just a few moments. We're talking with Joel Dyer, author of Harvest of Rage. Joel, what I'd like to do is, if we can, to some degree, move to the results of this.
Right.
I mean, you draw a very, very poignant picture in part of the book Harvest of Rage when, you know, you're talking about this farmer whose life is destroyed, and I picture him sitting in kind of a darkened room, you know, drinking, depressed, with a gun in his hand, and you know, not knowing where to turn, and basically there's nowhere for this person to turn as their lives have fallen apart, and that's a huge void. And there has been a number of individuals, groups, and organizations who have stepped in to fill that void, correct?
That is correct, Mike. What happens, we've kind of talked about the downside, we've talked about the what leads people to this point of depression and frustration and how they end up there, and how, you know, at one time there was this rural mental health mechanism and hotlines and church workers who could come to their house and help them to get through it. What that really is all about is that when a person has been, you know, under stress for a long time, and you have to remember that the average foreclosure takes anywhere from 2 to 10 years, so it's not an overnight thing. So you live under this stress for a long time. It's very much like a post-traumatic stress syndrome that someone would experience from, you know, Vietnam War or any other war, and or other traumatic event. But people get into that position, and they become in desperate need of support. And all people, you know, anyone find themselves in that at that point, they need support badly. And basically, they're going to find that support wherever they can. We used to get it from the church groups and the mental health care workers that were out there to help us during the rural crisis of the 80s, but once that funding for those programs were done away with, and the perception among the public that we didn't need them anymore, there was a void that was left. Where were people who were going through these terrible times going to find their support? And they found them in a what in one sense seems like an unusual place, but it really is quite logically. They found them in a lot of the anti-government groups that were already existing, but had never been particularly well-populated or dominant, you know, out in a rural culture. And suddenly when people, you know, if you went out to a farm auction in the 90s, you know, it wasn't uncommon at all to look over and the fellow that you'd see with his arm around the farmer who was being sold out was a guy from the local militia or the Christian Identity Church or the, you know, local John Birch Society, someone who was there saying, hey, this isn't your fault. This is the government's fault, you know. And that is a very powerful message of support. It really, it helps us to scapegoat. It helps people in rural America to scapegoat their frustrations and their depression over their economic situation, and to find a lot of people that had gone through similar circumstances, and to basically join in and find the support that they needed at that time, which, I mean, I'll be honest, there probably were a lot of people who were depressed to the point of being suicidal that very likely found enough support through those anti-government mechanisms to move on with their life. Not in what I would think of as a very healthy manner, but they were able to keep going.
Well, certainly what happens is you have people who are isolated and alone, and you know their lives are falling apart, and in walks someone, perhaps someone very charismatic, who says, you know, none of this is your fault. It all has to do with this other thing or these other people, and you know, here you go. You know, here's your opportunity to find something to hold on to.
And not only is it often a message of helping us to scapegoat our troubles onto the government, it also has a very comforting factor in the sense that there's usually a very strong religious message there as well. It's, you know, this is all about the end times. This is about the Jewish conspiracy. The Jews have taken over the banking system and the newspapers, and now they're taking over the farms so they can control the food supply, and you know, you need to join us so that we can fight off the, you know, Jews for the, you know, so that we can, you know, restore a Christian nation and before the second coming of Christ. So there's this really strong religious element to it, and again, religion is a very powerful comforter, as it should be during tough times. But when it's a religious political message that seems to make sense, it makes it very, very often that someone will accept that as gospel, so to speak.
Well, there's the scapegoating aspect of all of this, which, as you so stated, I mean, very often it's anti-Jewish, it's also anti-immigrant, it's also anti-black, it's also anti-Hispanic, and there's all of this scapegoating of why you're having these problems. It's because of these folks, and if we could just focus all of our energy and rage at them somehow or another, that's going to fix everything. I mean, it is a very powerful message.
Right. And what happens is if you sort of view the whole anti-government movement as a giant funnel, you know, at the top you see a lot of people being drawn into it. And you know, at the most basic level, it's sort of the fundamentalist ideas of that the Constitution is sort of derived from the Bible, and we're not really supposed to live in a democracy as much as a theocracy. That's one element that brings people in. Then there's the other big pouring into the scoop of, say, the National Rifle Association. And I'm, you know, personally, you know, I grew up in a place where everybody had guns in Oklahoma as a kid, and I don't have a big problem with that. You know, when you looked at some of the literature during the 1990s that the NRA was putting out, it was extremely paranoid, extremely anti-government, you know, saying things like, you look at Ruby Ridge, you know, they killed Randy Weaver's wife, you know, they killed his child. When are they going to kick in your door and do the same to you? So it really played on that fear. And so that kind of rhetoric also poured a lot of people into that anti-government funnel. But at the top of the funnel, it's really more of a political movement. It really is, I won't say harmless, because of what happens is you get exposed to all of these conspiracy theories and this very hardcore revisionist kind of view of the Constitution in the United States. But you look at the other end of the funnel, and out of all the people that get poured into that top, a few people will make it all the way down through the funnel, which the small end of the funnel is, say, a Tim McVeigh or a Terry Nichols, the people that, that really have the capacity to do very much, you know, a great deal of violence and harm. And so, you know, what happened during the sort of the restructuring of the rural economy through globalization, through monopolies in the food industry, you know, through moving the low-income manufacturing jobs that were always dumped in rural America are now in Malaysia or someplace. What happened were it poured a lot more people into the funnel, which virtually guarantees more violent people coming out the other end of the funnel. So that was really one of the, you know, the reasons that we saw the unbelievable growth in the 90s of the anti-government movement and our tendency toward domestic terrorism. It's really about economics, and it's no longer just limited, obviously, to rural America. You know, we're also seeing, you know, areas where, you know, good manufacturing sector jobs are shipped overseas, and those people who go through foreclosure on their homes because they've lost their jobs, that type thing, also are very vulnerable. I believe it's Michael Moore who has a great line. You know, he always says, people always ask me, who is the Michigan militia? He says it's the unemployed arm of the UAW. There's an incredible consistency of economic problems that bring people into that movement. And it shows two things. One, it shows that the left is doing a really lousy job of reaching out and trying to help the 24 million white Americans who live in poverty. You know, all the rest of the minorities in the United States make up about 20 million Americans who live in poverty. But it's easy to fundraise around helping blacks or Hispanics or women or children or whatever. It's really difficult to fundraise around trying to help impoverished middle-aged white men. And so that is a group of people that is completely overlooked by the left, and that leaves the door wide open for this sort of right-wing recruiting among that demographic.
Well, you bring up a really interesting point, and that is, of course, that the left has either consciously or subconsciously, but I think to some degree consciously, abandoned all of these people by saying, oh, they're just the angry white males and we can't have anything to do with them. And so therefore they're left with no one to provide any other analysis for their difficulties other than groups like the Church of the Creator or the Aryan Nations or any of these other Christian identity or militia groups. I mean, because there's just no one else there competing for the hearts and minds, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's entirely accurate, Mike. I mean, the left, which I consider myself, I guess I would have to say I align with that, although there's a lot of areas, like I say, with gun control where I'm constantly attacked by the left. You know, so, you know, who knows? You know, I don't ever try to figure out exactly where I am. I would like to see everyone in the United States, you know, be able to, like, make a living, feed their kids, and get an education. I guess that makes me a liberal. What happens on the left is we don't like to talk about, we tend to have just as much bigotry in determining who is downtrodden and who is left out of the system as the right has in determining, you know, who is worthy of being blessed with good economics. So, you know, the right and left work very much the same way. You know, neither of them are trying to look out for everyone. You know, we tend to just pick and choose who we're going to look at. And don't get me wrong, I'm not standing here, you know, or sitting here trying to say that, you know, we shouldn't be doing what we're doing for blacks and Hispanics and women and children, and we should do it instead for white men. I'm just saying that, you know, again, the 24 million white Americans living in poverty, which is the majority of all people living in poverty, need to have as much interest being shown by the left in trying to help them get their lives back together as is happening with any other demographic group. A final thought would be to get out into rural America. You know, we have this misunderstanding that everything out there is peaceful and wonderful and that people are living these happy, beautiful lives, you know, walking around with the horses. The reality is 27% of the kids in rural America go to bed hungry at night, living in poverty. That's 1% more than the inner city. We have to take a hard look at this restructuring of the rural economy that's going on. We've just gone through this unprecedented 8-year boom, they tell us, an economic boom, yet rural America now is in much worse shape than it was 10 years ago. So people in the city are the only ones who have the voting power to change it, yet they don't even know what's going on in rural America. So, you know, urbanites, let's educate ourselves. Let's go out. Let's find out who these people in rural America are and figure out how to help them in this time of crisis.
Joel Dyer, author of The Harvest of Rage. Thank you for being with us on the program. We'll have you on again.
Thanks. Love to do it again, Mike. You
great.
Take care.
You too. Thank you for joining us for this edition of the program today. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and it's been my pleasure to be part of the team bringing you Full Logic Reverse. If you'd like more information about FLR, you can contact us via email, flr@jps.net, or by telephone, 530-271-0804. We invite you to join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.